Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. Welcome to the Metron Live podcast, coming to you from our new location. And I don't think, is this still considered Midtown? This is the Kirkwood neighborhood. So we're in the historic part of ATL. Metron people, would you welcome the podcast people? And not only are we doing the podcast, we're actually doing an In the Now with Jim Swilly program. So that will be, like those of you that are streaming on the Bish in the Now page on YouTube, you'll see that there's a whole channel that's just the In the Nows, which I've been doing them, not regularly for the last however many years, but we have been doing them. I'm especially, what's the word? I'm happy, I'm blessed, this is a very meaningful day to me because my firstborn son is with us today. He's in he started a band when he was in high school. They're called the Black Lips, and that however many years that's been. They have a worldwide following. He just got back from a tour in Southeast Asia where they went to Australia and Vietnam and Cambodia, and there's one other place you went, Thailand. And they did a movie about their Middle East tour some years ago. And at the end of this month, he's going back to the UK. And so they have a, you know, it's a very full schedule. He doesn't do as much domestic traveling now as they once did. And for over a year now, he's been helping out with taking care of my mom, which is a blessing. There's no way to tell you how much I appreciate that. But I specifically wanted to talk to Jared about something today, and he's amenable to it. And I'm going to make some opening statements. But without any further ado, I would like you to welcome my son, Jared Swilly. Jared, would you come on up? Just take a seat right there. Hey, y'all, come in. Cute. Before we get started today, let me say a couple of things. I posted something a few weeks ago because when Jared was in, when he was in Melbourne, Australia, that Black Lips played a gig and somebody in the crowd came up to him and they had just heard a speaking that he did at an AA meeting. They'd heard it online. And it was really cool because here's somebody in Australia who's come to hear the music, but they connected with him because of his recovery. And so I posted that, and somebody asked me, they said, is Jared cool with you doing that? And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, you know, the A in that title is anonymous. I said, just so you know, I've never posted anything without checking with him first and making sure he's cool with it. And he has assured me, as recently as even yesterday, we talked about this. He said, no, I'm an open book. I'm totally fine. So I want you to know I absolutely respect people's anonymity. And I never would post anything that's not pre-approved. But he is very much involved with not just AA, but also with the leadership of it. He's currently leading a group and goes to, I don't know how many meetings a week. And which is a good thing. But we specifically want to talk about some things today. And at the end of it, I want to just have a prayer over any of you that may have two things. A family member, especially a child, an adult child, that perhaps you're estranged from for whatever reason. I want to speak a blessing of reconciliation over you. And then anybody that has somebody in your circle, in your family, whatever, that has a situation with substance abuse, I want to speak something over them. Not a prayer for deliverance, but a prayer that they'll own their situation and do something about it. And I believe when we're in this setting, I believe the power of agreement is ramped up. I think it's even stronger. So good things are going to happen today. Miracles are going to take place. And I'm very, very happy for Jared agreeing to do this. There's a book I'm going to refer to and lots of other things. Where I want to start with you, I'm trying not to call you Gerard. I always call I have a nickname for each of my kids, and his is Gerard. I don't know why. I've been calling them that for a long time. But, hey, bud, come on in. Will, that's Jared sitting right there if you want to sit there. Oh, well, then y'all might want to, y'all find it. Hey, come in. Welcome. Good. We've had quite a journey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've had quite a journey. We've gone through periods of time, not because of any problem, but just because you were traveling so much, you've been out of the country so much. I'd go for like long periods of time and not even know where you were. And the fact that we're so much in each other's lives now, I mean, we have dinner once a week with him and if his brothers are in town.
Well, twice a week, really.
Yeah, right, because we go to Mom's on Sundays. And if you had told me a few years ago that this would be our new normal, I thought, I don't know how that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I just see my youngest one come in. Hey, bud. Welcome. But we had a situation many, many years ago where you went to rehab and you were introduced to recovery and 12-step program then. My first question to you is, and you can share as much as you're comfortable with, as much or as little. What's different now? Because you've currently post, it's more than 2 years sober. It's like close to 2.5 years sober, right?
Yeah.
So why now? Like, 'cause back in the day, you were introduced to the program and, you know, you made stabs at it. You went to some, but life happened, rock and roll happened. Yeah. The rock and roll, and you guys will know what I'm talking about, the rock and roll world is not really conducive to sobriety. And I asked him recently, I said, do you have a lot of support with people in rock world? He said, well, at my age, people who abuse substances are either dead or in recovery. So the people who are still alive are definitely in recovery. So,
yeah.
So what's different now? Like what? Why did it take now? Because I've watched you for the last 2 years, and you've been super consistent with the meetings. So what's different now?
Well, there's a couple reasons. I guess like the main one is recovery can't come to anyone who's not 100% ready. Like you can't force it on anybody. That's why I'm kind of ambivalent about interventions. I believe they serve a purpose to like show someone that, you know, there's people that care about them and that could spark something. But after that, you can lead a horse to water. So that's like the short answer. I wasn't ready. And then, you know, there's maturity that comes along with it and just life experience. And there's, you know, to get into recovery, you have to be at the, to get into this program, like the first step, it's a 12-step program, and the first step is surrendering. And it sounds easy when you say it and sounds really simple, but I mean, it has to be all the 12 steps, we say progress, not perfection a lot, but there's one you have to do perfectly, and that's the first one, which is to basically admit complete defeat. Because you're not going to be open, because it's all honesty, openness, and willingness. And if you're harboring any sort of doubts or think there's something left in you, and if you just haven't been totally beat down, you're not going to do that. And you're not going to really, and we'll probably get into this eventually during this, but you're not really going to have the spiritual experience it takes to go through the process. Because I couldn't have gotten to where I am now on a human power. I was powerless. So to initiate that spiritual experience, you have to be, I mean, people call it rock bottom. If you haven't hit your bottom yet, and I tell guys, you know, I sponsor guys, And there's some people I tell when I'm talking to, and it's hard to say it to them, but some people I'll say, like, I don't think you're done yet. I think you need to go out and do you have an experience that you need to go try some controlled drinking. I don't think you think you still have it in you. And they'll say, no, I really want this. I'm like, yeah, you say you do, but you have to believe, like, in your core. It has to be complete and utter surrender and defeat. And when I was 17, I was really immature. I was invincible. I wasn't done. And, who knows, maybe I'm really happy with where I am now. I believe God works in mysterious ways. I had a path to follow, and it wasn't my time then.
When I first mentioned to him about doing this, he brought up this book to me. It's called Breathing Underwater by Richard Rohr. And what was interesting is, I don't know that much about Richard Rohr, but so many times when I've been looking for quotes about Christian universalism and Christian mysticism, and his name always comes up. He's a Franciscan monk, right?
Yes.
And he has a place in Albuquerque, I believe. So it's like a
hermitage, I think.
It's a retreat center where people come for healing. Anyway, his name kept coming up because his book called The Universal Christ. And he writes definitely on the page with where I'm at. I didn't know he'd written anything about recovery. And this book is called Breathing Underwater. And the reason it's called that, we were talking about this yesterday, it comes from a line in a poem by somebody. And the point is this, and this is one reason I want to do this today. I come from a background where I would hear people say, Jesus delivered me, or they prayed for me and I got delivered from drug addiction or alcoholism or whatever. And if that was if that was your experience, that's awesome. Good for you. I can tell you that is the exception and not the rule. And so the reason he calls it Breathing Underwater is, the concept is, if you're thrown into the ocean, you can pray that somebody comes, fishes you out and rescues you, but it's unlikely if you're in the middle of the ocean that that's going to happen. So the alternative is to learn to breathe underwater. And I love that concept because, the book you have here, this is the book by Bill Wilson. It was written in
1935.
And this is the tried and true. Like, if you've ever read the Serenity Prayer, he didn't write the Serenity Prayer, but that's what he made it famous. Some guy starts with an N, Nor, or somebody. He's attributed with that prayer. But it's the concept is, God grant me the serenity to... what is it? The courage to change the things.
Accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know
the
difference.
And the wisdom of the difference. So, and the other thing I love about the whole AA concept is definitely pro higher power, but the theology is very fluid. It's like whatever and whoever God is to you, you have to call on that. And for you, that's the Jesus of the Bible and the Holy Spirit. That's great. If for you it's consciousness and higher self and the universe, that's fine. I think that was very much ahead of its time. And that's why when you started listening to me some on Sundays, you would say, what you're teaching is so similar to what I'm hearing in some of the groups. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I do see a lot of parallels because, I mean, I think the genius of this book was, it actually stemmed from a Christian group before that started, I think around the 20s, around Prohibition era, called the Oxford Group. And they kind of had, it was very similar, and Bill Wilson got his ideas from that. Basically how it started, I mean, there was a lot of, Carl Jung was involved. But, when you're trying to alcoholics and addicts are, you know, a difficult bunch. So if you come at them with theology or doctrine, you know, that's going to chase a lot of people away. When you're coming into, you know, the first step is surrender. And so, you know, and you identify the problem. Well, how do you fix that problem? You need a power, and you have to access that power, because human power is not going to do that. So the second step is came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. For me, that's God, pretty much like the Christian God. But for other people, it can get, you know, it can be harder to get there. So once they admit, like, defeat, like, you can start off slow. Like, do you believe in any power greater than yourself? I mean, you can, the sun, or, you know, it can be whatever. I know a guy that's working with an alcoholic right now that's like, you know, can Bobby Cox be your higher power? You know, that's not going to work in the long term, but just to hook that. I know a guy, my first sponsor when he was in, he got 5150'd, which is like involuntary commitment to a psychiatric hospital. And he was in there for a long time, and his higher power became the doorknob, because he couldn't, you know, that was the thing that was keeping him in that room.
Wow.
Eventually he got around that, but that was, that doorknob was a door, and that was, he couldn't open that door. That was more powerful than him. And, you know, I've even told guys that they're like, I can't believe in this. I'm like, well, do you believe it worked in me? They're like, well, yeah, I can see that. We're like, I'm like, well, you can borrow mine. Like, borrow my higher power. But yeah, and it's like, it has to be a conception of your own higher power. Because if you bring in like theology and doctrine and all that stuff, a lot of this book was also really inspired by the Sermon on the Mount, like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And there's even a book by Emmett Fox. And when you read that, you can tell that it's heavily influenced by this. And in Sermon on the Mount, you know, it's talking about like, you know, a lot of the stuff the Pharisees did. You know, that's not, it's all spiritual stuff. Like all these vestments and these rituals you do, that's all like human created. And the whole thing is like, at least for me and my spirituality, it's like, there's so much I don't know. I'm open to everything, but there's so much I don't know. And it's really like, this book is really just, the steps are like a treasure map or a recipe or a way to have a spiritual experience and have like conscious contact with God, a God of your understanding. And it can really be whatever, you know. In my program, I speak to people about spirituality, and we talk about God all the time. I don't know what their, you know, the majority of the time, I don't know what their belief system is, or what their, and it doesn't really matter. Like even in here, you know, they talk about before we had meetings and sponsorship in like the 30s, it was, you know, it does say, be quick to see where religious people are right. And be quick to see where religious people are right. But that doesn't necessarily, like, it's basically just takes all like the good parts of what I think are the good parts of Christianity, the stuff without baggage, the stuff without like human, just stuff that's not really in the Bible or anything. It's just no theology and no doctrine. It's a path to spirituality. And I really believe that any like seeking of God or spirituality, you can really go like, this is my route through AA, through this book. You know, the Jews have it, Hindus have, you know, really, there's not just one route to God.
It's interesting what you said about the guy saying the doorknob, this is higher power. I completely understand that, because it's access. I remember somebody was, Marianne Williamson was doing a call-in show, and this woman called in and said, I don't know that I even believe in God anymore, but I feel like I want to pray, and I don't know how to pray, and there's so much that I came out of that's irrelevant to me now, and I don't know what. And so she said, well, how were you raised? She said, I was raised Roman Catholic. She said, well, pray the rosary. That's what you know. So start there, and that's your access point. And I thought, that's so smart, because yeah, our belief system is so much a part of our DNA that if somebody says, oh, that's BS, don't follow that anymore, it automatically cuts off your access point.
Yeah, and it's just gaining access to that. It really is like whatever works for you. I mean, we do have like, you know, I believe all the principles that we practice in this program are fundamentally very Christian, or, you know, I don't know a lot about other religions, but the fundamentals of what Jesus taught, all of our principles, like, you know, honesty, helping other people out, like all this stuff. It's just the meat and potatoes of all the good stuff. And it's just trying to get that conscious contact with God. However you get conscious contact with the God of your understanding, that's the path you take. Like, you know, I grew up in church and around it all the time. I would have never called myself an atheist, but I also would have never called myself spiritual at all. It was just this thing that was there. I was never against it or anything, but really my first interaction with spirituality was through this program, and it took me, you know, some, like, oh, I hear a lot of people say in my program, like, pain is the touchstone of all spirituality, and it took me a lot of pain to get there. And it was really my first connection with God and, you know, the God of my understanding.
We speak for the whole family. We're super proud of you. And the reason I think your story is important on a day like today to bring it up is because we do have a lot of history. And, you know, you've assured me that, you know, you're an open book and you're fine with talking about anything. Suffice it to say, you've, without sounding dramatic, you've been to hell and back. I mean, you have.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so many times there's things that have happened. Some of it over the years, I've shared a little bit with you all along, but some of it I've never told. And it was this, I remember us having a conversation where, I said, I don't know how many more of these you're going to get. I mean, you keep being supernaturally, I mean, I can't, there's no way to tell you how many times his life has been supernaturally saved. And I remember finally having a conversation where I said, I don't know how many, I think you're running out of these. And Jonah standing over there, Jonah and I had a conversation one time, and, it's hard to talk about, but you remember the conversation I'm talking about, Jonah, where, you know, I said, I've stood in faith for him for so long, but I think we're going to have to plan life without him. I mean, I just don't know how many more, I don't see how he's going to keep surviving this, you know, and it wasn't just giving up, but at a certain point, you know, there's this reality that this is not getting better, and this is going on for years. And I think it's very interesting what you said about the intervention thing, too, because it sounds good in theory, and sometimes it works. Sometimes it's good for people to, you know, have a kick in the pants. But you have to, something has to happen that's your road to Damascus. I mean, it just does. Something has to happen to you, and it's a turning point. It's going to be like, well, you're either going to die or you're going to do this. And you know, over the years, especially in the past, in Christian world, I would hear people nearly not look down on AA, but it was kind of like, well, that's not relative to us, because the idea is I'm an alcoholic and this is a disease I have, and I'm not looking for I'm going to be done with this. I recognize this is a part of my life that I've got to maintain. And, you know, in church world, we would say, well, no, come to Jesus and Jesus will fix it. But Eddie can tell you from counseling with people go to church and say they were fixed. They were not fixed. And, you know, you'd meet with them in a counseling appointment and you think, that was good what you said in service, but this is not your reality. And that's one reason I love this. I'm not selling this book, but I loved it. I have not read the whole thing, but I've read enough of it that I understand what it's about. And I love the idea of saying, this is a reality. This is not taking anything away from the power of God. It's just, this is a reality. It's in your bloodline. There's addiction that runs in the family. It is a disease.
Yeah.
And it's not defeatist to say, this is a reality. And in a lot of ways, so much about a, you know, typical AA or NA meeting, you know, people joke about, you know, somebody standing up and saying, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic, and everybody says hello. But that's really what church is supposed to be like. A church is supposed to be a place where everybody removes the facade and says, this is who I am, and I need this support, because you, I don't know how many meetings a week you average, but every time I see you, I picked him up from Vietnam, or he had just flown in from Cambodia, Thailand, somewhere. And he said, I've got a meeting. I said, how are you going to get to one? He said, I'm doing it online. But he hadn't slept in 48 hours, but he said, no, you've committed to lead a group for 6 months. So you're, yeah. And, that's awesome. Cause I could see, you know, it'd be really easy to say, I just got back from the other side of the world. I'm going to sit this one out. But you seem to have gotten past that. I mean, you really see the value of committing to it.
Well, you were like to talk to your point of like talking about how like you pray for someone and then they're delivered. Well, yeah, I've experienced the power of God and I've experienced a full fundamental spiritual experience, which some people could just call a perspective change or a personality change. But it's not like magic. Like we have this step 6 and 7, which is like, you know, you pray to have your care. Once you earlier in the steps, you find your character defects, you do a big moral inventory and you go through that process. And yeah, you do pray to have your character defects removed and you do all these other things, but they don't just disappear. You have to work in tandem with that power. I mean, you don't just like sit there and it's, you know, it takes work. I mean, it's a very simple program, but it does take work.
Cause you've sponsored some people that have kind of relapsed. So,
I would say our success rate, if you look at just the people who walk into an AA meeting, it's pretty bad, maybe like 5%. And you just have to get used to that. At first I was, you know, I would get really, you know, discouraged when people would walk out, but you just kind of got to keep doing your thing. I will say that 100% of the people who have done exactly what this says, there's a 100% recovery rate. But a lot of people, they don't really get past that first step. They think they still have it in them.
Don't you think some people come in with the idea, I'm going to go to, like some people come out of rehab and they're like, I'm going to go to this thing and I'm going to get fixed. And then like, no, I did that. I'm done. And they want to move on from it. And that's, again, not really reality.
Well, no, because there's no finish line. I mean, this is a disease that it's not a moral dilemma. You know, people from all walks of life, it happens to. I have this thing inside me that, you know, it's estimated around 10% of the population has that's trying to kill me. And it's a lifetime commitment. And when I say work, to me it doesn't seem like work. I go to about 7 meetings a week. I sponsor guys. I mean, once I get done from here, I'm driving someone to rehab. That doesn't seem like work to me. After I've gone through this, at first you think like...
A lot of these you're doing online, but you...
No, in person. On Sunday nights, I host my own meeting. I'm in person almost all the time. And when I travel, a little more online. But at first, it seems daunting. Like, oh, I have to wake up and meditate every day. Oh, I have to pray every day. I have to call other alcoholics. I have to go to these meetings every day. I mean, after I had a spiritual experience, it does it to me. It's not work. It's something I enjoy now. But also, like the 12th step is about carrying the message to other alcoholics, and that's what keeps me sober, and that's what keeps me in it. Like giving back what was so freely given to me. I remember when I first came in, I was stunned because this man I had never met in my life. He was recommended me to me by a friend. It was during the pandemic and spent almost 3 hours a day with me on Zoom going through this work with me for months. And then, you know, I eventually, and this was an elderly man. He's like, we had never met.
Is that the guy that was the priest?
He was wounded in the Vietnam War, became addicted to heroin over in Vietnam.
His first sponsor was a man who was about my age, who was
no gay, older than you,
who was gay and had been in the ministry. I thought, there's no way that was a fluke. Like, how is that possible that you that you've ended up with somebody that's basically me?
There's a lot of, I mean, once you start going through this, like, you know, people, like, especially like a lot of alcoholics, they want like proof, and really the proof is through doing all this stuff. I mean, there's on my own self-knowledge and my own will, I know that drinking is bad. I know it would kill me. I could know that all day, every day, and I would still drink. After doing this for a while, and I came into this saying, like, there's no way this will work on me, but I don't have any other options. So I thought, like, at best, I'll just be cloistered, and if I can just abstain from alcohol, I won't get in trouble anymore. And it'll just be a really dull, gray life, and that will be at best. But I'm just going to give it a shot. And then, you know, a while down the line, other people notice before you do, usually. I just realized one day, I was like, I have no desire to drink at all. And it's through this process of doing these steps. And then once you get to the part, that's why sponsorship is so big. It's like carrying the message, and not just to other alcoholics, it's being of service whenever you can, because so much of my disease is based on self-centeredness. It's on me. It's like, we call it the bondage of self. And I pray every morning to be relieved from the bondage of self. And so when I'm, disturbed or something's, you know, when we're going through that like monkey brain chatter, and it's just me, my financials, like everything, my first thought is to, like, my book says to immediately turn your thoughts to someone you can help. I pray to have it removed, and then I think of someone else and see how I can be of service to someone else. And then 30 minutes later, it's like, I can't even remember what I was thinking about. But that's how this process works. It's just like, it's a mutual aid society, and it's completely free. I was just amazed, because when I was working with my first sponsor, he'd be there with hours a day with me on the computer. And during that time, it was the first time I saw.
During the pandemic.
Yeah. And I started seeing a professional therapist also on Zoom. So this guy would work for hours for free with me. And he'd always tell me, actually, you're helping me more than you know. Like, that, and now I understand that. At that time, I didn't know, but then I'm paying the therapist $300 an hour. I no longer use a therapist. But it's just like a beautiful way this program works. And I see that it's just something every day. I see the power of God in it. So when I'm telling you people there, you can start their higher powers as Bobby Cox or a doorknob, eventually they get over that, and they're like, oh, and once you see this stuff in action, and you see the supernatural all the time, then it's like people come to believe pretty fast, or they go out and die. You know, that's just like,
everybody deals with addiction on some level. Like, some people are addicted to fear. They're addicted to thoughts of destruction. They're addicted to the chemicals of wrong thinking. And that's why, we won't go through all 12 of the steps, but every one of them are valid. I think if you've never taken a drink in your life, there's something in those 12 steps that is going to be applicable.
Well, when you're talking about everyone's addicted to something, I mean, my life without the 12 steps or without God or without spirituality, if you're addicted to thinking or fear, you're trying to feel a different way. You're trying to control stuff. Like, through drugs and alcohol, you're trying to control the way you feel. And, you know, it's like all addictions are, you know, I don't know if you want to call them bad behaviors, but these things that aren't great for us, things that aren't spiritual. I just lost my train of thought really quick.
Everything you're saying.
But yeah, all these things, these 12 steps are ways to overcome those. But it's all about changing the way you feel and running on self-will. Like, really, it's like the third step, if you want to talk about the steps, but the third step is just aligning your will to God's will. Like, after you surrender, it's like, all right, I'm done running the show Just God's in charge.
Bullet point them. Go through what they are.
Well, the first step is admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Their lives have become unmanageable, and then that's the problem. All right, so what's the solution? Step two is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And so then you're like, well, I'm powerless. Where's my power? You have your higher power. The third will is turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand God. And that's really important as you understand it. So, you have the problem, you have your power, and then what are you going to do about it? The third step is really your decision. It's like, are you going to keep doing things your way, and are you going to keep running your life, or are you going to let God and this program run your life? Are you going to lead a spiritual life? Then your fourth step is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself, which is basically all the stuff that you've gone through in your whole life that's blocking your access to God. So we have like all your resentments. I didn't think I had any resentments. I was like, I just like to party. I'm a rock and roll band. I like to have a good time. But once you get through these, you realize all these things that are blocking you. So all of your resentments, it could be, obviously a lot of exes are on there. People's parents are on there. The IRS, police, all these things. Your fears, because there's so much run on fear. And then like intimate relationships, and you look through these patterns and you go over like your whole life. And then you have your sponsor takes you through this. And the fifth step is, and the Catholics kind of do this. The fifth step is confessing, you read your fourth step to a sponsor, and they kind of, so much of this program is, I know my thinking is wrong a lot of times. And the beauty of this thing is I get different perspectives on that. So you go through that and you get completely honest. Like when I did my fifth step, it was the first time I was ever completely honest with another man. Then I do that daily with other guys. Like, hey, what's your take on this? Like, and I see things like, oh, okay, I didn't see it that way. And so that's like a constant thing. Sixth step is you're entirely ready to, remove all your character defects. You find a lot of your character defects in your moral inventory. And then seventh step is praying to have them removed. And, like I said, you say that prayer, but you still have to be vigilant about it. Your eighth step is made a list of all people you had harmed. Now, you're not going to, except for when to do so would injure them or others. So you make a list of everyone you've ever wronged, and it's not saying sorry. The ninth step is, and so you talk about like, how am I going to, which ones can I do first? Which ones could I do later? Which ones could I never do? Just get them down there. And then your ninth is going out there and doing those amends. Some you won't do in person because if it could harm you or the other person. But it's not about saying sorry. It's about amending something.
Explain what's the difference.
Well, when you say sorry, like when I was drinking, I said sorry all the time. Like, oh, I'm sorry, I crashed your car. I'm sorry, like I broke that. You're just like, sorry doesn't mean anything. It's just a word. Like amends is like, hey, I did this, so you're taking responsibility. What can I do to make this better? Like, how can I amend this? And a lot of these, like I have a sponsee, most guys I've sponsored, their first thing is they want to call up every girl they've ever dated and say like, hey, I'm sorry I did all this stuff. Usually we say like, don't contact your exes, like do a living amends. You're living better. You won't do that again. Because really when you're calling, and I'm just using, there's other examples, I'm just using exes as an example. You're saying, you're supposed to help the other person. That's more helping you feel better about yourself, like absolving yourself of guilt. Like they've gone on with their lives. They don't need to hear from you again, as long as you're not out there doing damage anymore. And the first nine is what really, after the ninth is when typically that's when you kind of trigger like your spiritual experience. And after a ninth step, you can start sponsoring other people and taking them through the steps. And steps 10 through 12 are, some people call them maintenance steps. I kind of like to call them growth steps, because your 10th step is, At the end of every day, I do a 10th step where I go over what my day was like. It's like a mini moral inventory, so you never really have to do the full thing again. Like, what did I add to the stream of life? Do I owe an apology? It's just like a rundown of your day. Because you want to do like a spot check. Like, anytime I catch myself getting back into self, or just keeps you on your toes, you know, keeps you clean. Because like the purpose of step four is cleaning house. And so you want to keep your house clean, keep your side of the street clean. And, ideally you do that every night. I do it most nights. Some nights I'm tired, but, 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation to improve your conscious contact with God. So when I wake up in the morning, that's when my mind is the most like active, like resentments can pop up. You think about crazy things, or how am I going to pay for this? And so I meditate and pray and try to like set your intention for the day. And because the whole thing is about keeping conscious contact with God and trying to constantly remember, like, I'm not running the show. A lot of times I'm just like, thy will be done. And that like kind of stops a lot of anxiety and me fighting and trying to control things. And a 12th step is also every day, like, practice these principles in all our affairs and carry the message to another alcoholic. And that's what I do to keep myself sober and to keep this thing going. Because if this wasn't here for me, I would have been in trouble. Like, before 1935, or before some of these groups popped up, if you were an alcoholic or had this thing, I mean, you basically, your options were jails, institution, or death. And now we have this thing. And if I didn't have that, and I think about that all the time, like, I wouldn't have had that to turn to.
Why do I hear you talk about gratitude so much? Why is gratitude so much a part of the equation?
Well, because I think that helps you keep in conscious contact with God. Self-pity and resentments are like two of the, I think, the biggest killers with people with my condition. I mean, or just the human condition. It's so easy to slip into negative and wrong thinking, because, I mean, really, I think, and I can sub alcoholism for just addiction or mental health stuff. I mean, all these maladies we have, if it's very easy to slip into that and to get in the wrong. Gratitude keeps you in a good perspective and a good frame of mind, because no matter, I mean, even yesterday I was signing up for a doctor's appointment. I had to answer like 16 questions. And I answered all of them but not been any medication. There's all 16 of them were just amazing ways to be grateful.
You would have said something entirely different 3 years ago.
Completely. And
like, who is this person?
Yeah. And I mean, gratitude is important for everyone. It just keeps you in a good frame of mind. I mean, if you can breathe today, I mean, there's always something to be grateful for everyone.
I love it. Does anybody have a question? If you've got a question you'd like to ask Jared, I'll do the Phil Donahue thing and run up there and hold the mic for you. Anybody got anything? We'll take a couple. Eduardo, what you got?
For Jared, how powerful is that? And if I cannot be blubbering, the brother right under me, James, and the brother under him, Joe, they both were alcoholics. They both died at 39 years old each, even though they were 5 years old apart. And back then, we just say they just drank themselves to death. And I just wanted to say that. And for Jared, I hope, because that is ministry in a sense that he's in, that it must be something for him to put himself in a place where he feels the weight of seeing other people through darkness.
Yeah. And you've watched a lot of your friends die. I mean, when you said either dead or in recovery, it's not hyperbole.
No, I mean, from the time I was a teenager, a few a month now, especially now that I'm in recovery, not necessarily people I'm super close to, but I mean, my first drummer, my first tour manager, I would have to sit here for a while and think of the amount of people. And these are all people that were in their teens and 20s. Constantly. I have a friend, one of my oldest friends, he was actually in the program for a while. He just went out and decided to have a beer. And, drugs have always been dangerous, but especially now, like with the fentanyl stuff, it's really a dangerous thing. And it's weird how you don't look at it as that dangerous. Like I said, I was like, oh, I just like, this is part of my job. I'm a rock and roll guy. This is what I'm supposed to do. I mean, alcohol seems, I don't have a problem with drinking. Like I'm fine. I'm around drinking all the time. I play music professionally, so I see it all the time, but it's so ingrained in our culture. You know, if you take it a little too far, it's a very, very dangerous drug. It's a very powerful drug, and people get addicted real quick.
Somebody else got a question or observation about anything? Brenda?
If somebody's been on drugs, say, the hard drugs, and then they go rehab and they come out, and I was always told that if you drink a little bit or take a little drugs, then you off to the races.
Yeah.
Is that true? Or if that person does it and he don't, is he on borrowed time?
I can't speak for everyone, especially in this thing. I always only speak from my experience. My experience tends to be what most other people's experiences I know are, but I do believe this is a disease. I can't have one beer. We have this thing.
And for years you thought you could.
I thought I could.
Yeah.
I call it the phenomenon of craving. There's a guy I'm going to help. Actually, two people I'm going to help right after this. One guy was a guy who was with us for about 6 months. He thought he could go do some controlled drinking in the first 2 months. He had consequences, I think his wife moved out. He got banged up a few times, but he just got back from Las Vegas after not sleeping for 10 days and doesn't really have a bank account anymore. And that's what, one Budweiser leads to. If you have this disease, it's a disease, and you can't have, there's no such, one beer is not enough, or no, one beer is too many, and 1,000 beers is not enough.
Yeah. Somebody else? Hang on, I'll be right back, Kevin. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And I went into treatment years ago with 23 people, and 22 died. And these were doctors and lawyers and grandmothers, pastors of all walks of life, kids all the way up into their 80s, and benzos and just opiates, alcohol. And I've noticed a trend of broken hearts that were self-medicating. I wanted to add a thought is I have found that I've been sober now for 6 years off opiates and prescribed opiates. 11 surgeries kind of led me to that space. Yeah. I want to say that I have found that relapse can be a part of recovery.
Yeah.
And you were talking about at the beginning of, I don't think you're ready yet, And I just wanted to share that with folks here. It might be going through seeing someone they love is never give up. Never, ever, ever give up. Protect yourself, of course, but the person, don't ever give up.
Yeah, certainly. Actually, I
thank
will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, and congratulations on your time. Relapse is certainly a part of recovery. It's absolutely abnormal that I'm not drinking right now. That's
right.
My instincts and my drives all tell me to do that. So, relapse is a part of recovery. I had relapses early on. I tried to do this. We call it dry time, but I did 6 months of dry time, which was hell. Because I had nothing to replace it with. I mean, alcohol was my solution to everything. I mean, they call it spirits. I mean, that was my spirituality. I mean, without alcohol, I was completely uncomfortable.
So just crazy. Because somebody stops drinking does not mean they're in recovery.
Abstinence has no part of this program, really. It's a spiritual solution. I mean, you can put someone in solitary confinement and they don't have access to alcohol. They're going to be crazy. If you don't replace it, in my opinion, in my experience, if you don't replace it with a spiritual solution and helping others and doing all this stuff, you're going to be, I mean, you meet an alcoholic that's not drinking and not running a program, and you're going to meet a really, probably not someone you want to be around.
Yeah.
And then some people do need relapse. Like the guy I'm meeting later today that just got back from this trip in Los Angeles. I only laugh because I'm just glad he survived. It was a ridiculous story. And I've been with him the past couple of days, and he needed that extra convincing. And we don't give up on people. Like, I'm fine. Someone can come to one of my meetings drunk every day for years. I'm never going to, unless they do something physical, we're going to welcome you with open arms all the time. And you can have 10,000 chances. I mean, as long as you're breathing, you could come in there. AA doesn't judge, and this program doesn't judge.
I appreciate your story, and I really like your music too. You might have an answer for this, you might not. How would somebody that's tried doing this get over the amount of their perceived control that AA has over them, and they relate it to years of being in fundamentalist religious control, have PSD from that.
Yeah.
And they feel like, well, they're just trying to control me, just like all that I was in. And I'm not going to do that. And it's very hard for them to get involved. It may be just indigenous to the meeting they were going to.
Yeah.
But they feel like this is the same control that I had growing up. And it's triggering me.
Yeah, well, I guess I think the key part of what you said is perceived control. I believe this is a disease of perception. The whole thing with this is all these things are suggestive only. You don't have to do any of this stuff. It's there. I'm sponsoring a guy right now who's kind of wishy-washy. And when I first started sponsoring, I wanted to call these people all the time, like, hey, are you all right? It's like, I'm here if you need me. You absolutely don't have to be here. Like, the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. And really, even it's a really loose program. And like I said, there's no doctrine or anything. And if you don't like the way someone's sponsoring, or if you don't like one meeting, there's 100 others you can go to. So really, it's not that I don't, I think when I say, we don't care what you do, we do care, but it's like, you can do whatever you want. Like, it's here. It's like, take it or leave it. But it's, and the thing is, it's always there. And you don't have to listen to what one sponsor says. Like, a lot of times, if, I'll go ask other people's opinions. Like, this is when I sponsor someone, all I'm doing, my only job is to share my experience and what worked for me. If that doesn't work for you, try someone else, and maybe their thing works better.
One thing, if you have a family member that drinks a lot, don't take all of their texts seriously, because when people drunk text. So we've been through some changes, and I'm coming to an end. But we went through a little period of time. We didn't speak for I don't know how long it was, at least a year. And if you don't mind me name dropping a little bit, he's friends with Sean Lennon, John Lennon's son. He produced one of your albums, and Yoko sang on it. But one night I saw his name come up, and I thought, uh-oh, what's this? Because I never know what, I remember one time I lived in Covington, I get this call 3 in the morning. I answer, and this guy says, hey, I just want you to know, Jared's all right. And I said, who is this? And it's some guy. I said, why wouldn't he be all right? He says, oh, well, he's been in the hospital for a couple of weeks for a concussion. He'd been in a bar fight. And I said, I did not know he was in the hospital. And but this later time, I hear this meant a lot to me because with all my kids, they're Beatles fans like I am. And I answered the phone. And he says, I said, hey, Jerry, because I never, you know, back in the day, I never knew, like, oh, crap, what's this going to be? And he said, I'm sitting here in John Lennon's studio. You know where they did the Imagine video where John and Yoko are sitting at the white piano? That's their house in upstate New York. And he said, I'm here in the studio. Sean just handed me his dad's bass. And he said, I want you to play dad's bass with this. He said, you're the only person I want to tell this to, but we're not speaking. I said, well, we're speaking now. And so, you know, Yoko might have broke up the Beatles, but she brought us back together. So there's that. But but I've had to, in a lot of ways, I've had to relearn you in the last couple of years because the way you would have responded to things before, you don't respond that way now. So it's been kind of a teachable moment. Ron, did you have a question?
Definitely want to thank you, Jared. My brother had an addiction and it took his life away, but I've always wanted to know what he was going through. And just hearing your experience, I can understand he didn't get to that point, but now I can understand the situation, how he was in rehab, out of rehab, and all that. He never did number one.
Yeah.
So as much as I prayed, my mama prayed, he never got to number one. And it just took him out here, but
We can't override somebody's will, but that's what we want to pray for, is bring people into a place where they will take responsibility. And I'll tell you this, even when Jared was a teenager, you know, a couple of times, early on, there was harder drugs. It's been alcohol the last several years. But I would say to him, I said, Jared, I don't know why, when I pray for you, I keep feeling like you're on drugs. And if you are, I want to help you. And he would say, oh, God, no. Like the way he would respond, like, how dare you say that? And I would think, I guess I'm wrong, you know.
Well, that disease makes you really good at lying.
Well, yeah, he would convince me, like, how would you think that I'm doing anything like that? And then, you know, when we went to rehab, I was like, oh, crap, what I thought was happening is really happening. So, again, you don't judge people for that. You just also, when you said you talked to that guy and it's the first time in your life you'd ever been honest, that's very important. Oh, hey, Constance. No, I couldn't see the shadow. Yeah.
Thank you again for your story. My question is, for a person that has been on drugs for like decades and decades, like over 30 years, and they want to get off drugs, but they go to methadone.
Yeah.
And you're only supposed to do methadone for so long, and then it's supposed to ease you off.
Yeah.
But it's like now they've been doing methadone for like over 10 years. Like, so they still need something.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I'm not in the medical field, but being around a lot of recovered opiate addicts, you know, Suboxone and methadone is, I guess they say, it's healthier than getting, like, you're not, like, getting street drugs, and I guess you're out of, like, the violence of that, but, I mean, it's...
But NA uses...
That's only my opinion is that, you know, it's still a drug.
It's still a chemical. But NA uses the same 12-step program that AA does, right?
It's similar. I haven't really done NA, but it's all based off the big book. They're like the... I think they're like the more like edgy version of AA. They like cuss and stuff like that.
Larry.
Thank you, Jared. Man, you're amazing. I know you're still working on it, but when you said earlier about your lineage, your heritage in Christendom, in the belief in Christ and in God, but it was the rock bottom that brought you to spiritual.
Yes.
A spiritual reality. Now, considering your famous father and what we've all gleaned from him and what you've gleaned from him, how is now that coming together, how is that coming into your spirituality different now? What makes you, what has made you mature and bring, my question, I got so many questions, but I'm trying to figure out and ask, where are you now with your identity with your father and God? What, where are you now with that?
I mean, I think it's been kind of amazing how, my spiritual journey and my dad's has been obviously very different paths to where, both to where we got now, but you know, there's a lot of parallels, and kind of, I think where I'm at spiritually, is pretty similar to my dad's. And at this time in my life, it's amazing how that happens. And I mean, I was exposed to so much religion and Christianity as a kid. And I was one of those, people always ask me, since I was in a rock band, like, oh, you must have rebelled and really not like the church and stuff. That was never my experience. I never had a problem with it at all.
Connected the dots.
I connected the dots.
Because you felt like, I'm doing the same thing. Like he used to say, I stand in front of on a stage and everybody dances and a mosh pit's like a Pentecostal, like I'm doing what you did. That's how you
usually see. But at the same time, at like worst, my rebellion was kind of like ambivalence. It was just something I never thought about. It was just never, not that it wasn't real for me. God wasn't a part of my life. I would have been like, if you would have asked me at any time in my life, do you believe in God? Do you believe in the resurrection? All that stuff. I would have said, oh yeah. Yeah, I believe in all that, of course, but I had never had a spiritual experience. I guess everyone's way to spirituality is different, but mine was hitting rock bottom with drugs and alcohol. Really rocketed me into the spiritual world.
Without going into detail, he went through a thing a couple of years ago where he actually flatlined twice in a hospital. So, I mean, in a very real sense, he's died and come back to life. And that will get your attention. There's nothing like going to the other side for a little bit and say, maybe I've got to do something about this. All right, Rhonda, and then we'll move on after this one.
Hey, just a quick question. As a parent, what would you do, like what would you suggest for a parent who just realized we have a problem with a 16-year-old?
Love.
I feel like we're preventing step one. We keep moving rock bottom.
With the child. I'm not.
Yeah. I feel like the love. We're almost to rock bottom, but the love snatches him before we let him hit rock bottom.
I mean, I don't, you know, there's never any right answer for this. Unfortunately, it's never, in my experience, I don't think it's ever something you can force. I mean, addiction is really hard. It breaks hearts. It breaks homes. You know, every case is different. The reason I say love is just like, there does come a time where there's only so much support you can give. You know, at some point it's a hard thing to navigate and there's no right answer for it. That's why something as nebulous as like, kind of like love is just like, that would just be my, cause I tried to think on like what would have happened to me. I mean, you could have had everyone in my life screaming in my face, telling me what to do and what was right. And I would have known like that was right, but for whatever reason, and I've had a lot of rock bottoms. The one that brought me in here wasn't even the worst that happened. Like there's stuff my family doesn't know about, like brushes with death I've had that are crazy. And it's a miracle that I'm alive. Don't give up hope and have love, you know?
Thank you.
Oh, huh? Oh, whew. Okay, Roz and then Fred.
First, I want to say applause to your socks. matching socks is so out. I've taught Celebrate Recovery in the prison system for a while, and our 12 steps is very similar to your 12 steps. Celebrate Recovery is the brainchild of Rick Warner, and we go through the very similar steps. However, we call it addiction, and I notice that you refer to this as disease. Will you talk about that?
I don't think there's a difference between addiction and disease. They're both things that are trying to kill you. Like, I call addiction a disease because it's a terminal illness. The good thing about addiction, though, is it's the only terminal illness with a guaranteed death sentence that is highly treatable, and it's 100%, like, the treatment's 100% effective.
Hey Jared, I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your story, and I want to encourage you. My dad was before he transitioned, he was 30 years sober, and he did the same things that you were doing. Once he realized where he was, he stayed at meetings 24/7, encouraging people. I saw him change people's lives, and it healed our lives.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I want to say something else to y'all. Like, y'all's kid 16, you know, I was there, you know, and I turned out all right. So, yeah, just don't give up hope. There's a lot of help out there, and, you know, could take time, but they could get better tomorrow. You never know. It's like more shall be revealed. You know, just, I mean, have faith in God, have faith in love, and just this whole process.
I've said this before, but if you had told me about 3 years ago, because he was living in LA at the time, if somebody had said, on Palm Sunday 2023, Jared's going to do a thing at Metron into his third year of sobriety, and he's going to move back to town and help you with your mom, because I'm an only child, and you know, I can't tell him. Like, if somebody had said that was going to be you don't even know this, but LaDonna, my cousin, she texted me Friday, and she said, "Hey, I just want you to know I was driving out of the subdivision," because her parents live virtually like across the street. And she said, "Jared's out there mowing your mom's lawn." And I just like to say, God's really good. And I said, there's not a day in my life that I don't. But my point in saying that to y'all even is, if somebody had said that, I would be like, what time does the spaceship for Jupiter leave? Because I believe all things are possible, but we've been going round and round with this for many, many years. I'm amazed he's survived what he's survived. And if there's other things I don't know, don't tell me. I can't take anymore. But because it doesn't matter. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like it doesn't, like, no matter what story you told us, it'd be like, well, it's still amazing. If somebody had said we'd be here today, I'd think, how is that even possible? So, all things are possible. Paul, I think your original question, if I interpret it right, was how much is unconditional love enabling somebody? And I don't think there's a specific answer for that. I think every situation is different. You have to find your equilibrium in because every family dynamic is different. But I will tell you this, it's not a fluke that you guys are here today. I'll tell you that. And if, for what it's worth, that should give you some hope. Hey, Robin. I went to elementary school with Robin. We actually had dinner a few months ago, but before that, we hadn't seen each other since seventh grade.
Whoa.
Yeah, so... So I'm really glad, because you live a good ways away from here. I'm glad you came down. The power of God's very strong in here. Thank you very much. Stand. Just remain standing. First of all, if you're a parent and your relationship right now with a child is challenged or severed or what, or just needs some reconciliation. Would you just raise your hand where you are? Okay. While your hand is raised, we add our faith to your faith. All things are possible. We speak life. We speak understanding. We speak reconciliation. We speak a Palm Sunday miracle. It's something will change if only just a little bit today. And it's first the blade, then the ear, then the full corn in the ear. And everybody in agreement with that said?
Amen.
For any of you that has somebody in your life, in your family, who has an addiction problem, would you raise your hand? Would you like to stand for? We add our faith to your faith. And we speak life and strength. We rebuke the spirit of death. We believe that they will survive until they can own their situation and find the way out of it. If AA is not it for them, that they'll find the way, but they also will not rule out the possibility that this may be the thing they've been looking for. And we're in agreement with that. And everyone said,
amen.
Amen. Praise the Lord. This was really, really, really good. Was I supposed to, are we ready to party now? Okay. We have to be out of here at 2:00. So, what? You're pointing to something and saying something, but I don't know what that means. Oh, okay. Should everybody sit back down? Okay. Would you please sit back down? What's this?
A cartoon for you. Metron. I don't want to put my back.
How do we do?
Is this okay?
This is okay. I'm just trying to think. How do we afford to do a car? it's a miracle. Apparently.
There are a number of people who love you. The drum roll. The band never stops playing love for you. So this is from Metron to you for your birthday.
Thank you.
We love you.
Thank you, everybody.
You're going to open it up.
Michelle's going to put it on the screen here for everybody else to see what he's going to see here.
So, this is the jersey that we made. And of course, for Bishop, we got your own number there.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate it. That's fantastic. I love it, love it, love it, love it. Oh, okay. Did you have anything else you wanted to say? Give me a hug. Fantastic. All right. Don't you love this location? I love this whole vibe. And I love when Avery did the shout out. She called it Next Level Sunday. And I think that's what I feel like. Next Sunday's Easter. Johnny Almanzo, the cello player, is going to be here. And I'm going to be doing things a little differently. I'm not going to use a musical guest quite as much because it's just kind of a different, it's just a different vibe. I'm going to do more meditation, whatever. But before we officially dismiss, let me remind you, there's no more mobile Metron, so we'll be here next Sunday at 11. Also, don't forget that meditation weekend number 18 is coming up on April 29th and 30th. We'll be back in St. Simon's. It's our fifth time going to St. Simon's. It's always magical when we go there. So that Sunday, there will be nothing going on here, okay? But the following Sunday, we'll be back here. I'm not going to play an outro, but if you want to support Metron, because we'll be paying rent here every week, and, you know, we do have expenses. So if you go to bishinthenow.com, it couldn't be easier. then, and if you haven't signed up for the shout outs, that thing we've been sending out every week for 9 years. And all the stuff that people text me during the week and ask, it's always in the shout out. I can always tell who doesn't get it because where's the thing, Adam? Did you read the shout out? The what? That's why you don't know. So, you can sign up for that at bishopthenow.com. Isn't that correct? So, I appreciate that. Did you have something you're saying? You're about to say something. Okay. So, we'll officially end that. There's another, client that's coming in. Oh, thank you, Constance. I just saw your gift come in. At 2 o'clock. So we'll need to be out of here by then, but we've got a good time, to finish. So I'll officially dismiss and then
we'll,
oh. Okay. That will work. Everybody stand. I speak a blessing over you. You're blessed when you come in, blessed when you go out, blessed in the city, blessed in the country, blessed in the basket, blessed in the store. Good things have happened today. Good things have been spoken into existence. Lives ultimately will be changed and saved because of things that were said here today. So we celebrate this resurrection week. We celebrate life. We celebrate new beginnings. We celebrate new possibilities. And I say that when you do leave the premises here today, that the blessings follow you. When the night is cloudy, there is still a light that shines on you. And when you wake up tomorrow, you will say, "This is the day the Lord has enabled me to make. I will rejoice and be glad." All right. You're officially dismissed, but don't leave. Stay and party with us.